for the tiny asteroidal diamond studs in her ears. He hadn't noticed any of it. "We've got to be more selective in our screening processes," he said, without looking up from the display. His voice was low, richly vibrant. He spoke American English, but with an overlay of a glass-smooth, cultured British accent. "Look." Eberly thumbed his remote controller, and the display rotated above the desktop so that Susan could see the three-dimensional chart. The office was small and austere, nothing in it but Eberly's gray metal desk and the stiff little plastic chair Susan was sitting in. No decorations on the walls. Eberly's desktop was antiseptically bare. She leaned forward in the uncomfortable, squeaking chair to inspect the series of jagged-colored lines climbing steadily across the chart, floating before her eyes, just as she had remembered it from last night, before she'd gone home for the evening. "In the 2 weeks since you've started working in the Human Resources office," Eberly said, "successful recruitments have climbed almost 30%. You've accomplished more work than the rest of the staff combined, it seems." "That's because I want to please you," she said to herself. She didn't have the nerve to say it out loud, didn't have the nerve to do anything more but smile at him. Unsmilingly, he continued, "But too many of the new recruits are convicted political dissidents, troublemakers. If they caused unrest on Earth, they'll probably cause unrest here." Her smile crumpled. She asked, "But isn't that the purpose of this mission? The reason we're going to Saturn, to give people a new chance, a new life?"
"Within reason, Holly, within reason. We don't want chronic protesters here, out-and-out rebels. The next thing you know, we'll be inviting terrorists to the habitat."
"Have I done that bad a job?" She waited for him to reassure her, to tell her she was doing her job properly. Instead, Eberly got to his feet and came around the desk. "Come on. Let's go outside for a bit of a stroll." She shot to her feet. She was just a tad taller than he. From the shoulders down, Eberly was slight, skinny, really. Thin arms, narrow chest, even the beginnings of a pot belly, she thought. "He needs exercise," she told herself. "He works too hard in the office. I've got to get him outside more. Get him to the fitness center. Build him up." Yet, she followed him in silence down the hallway that led past the habitat's other administrative offices and out the door at its end. Bright sunshine was streaming through the long windows. Colorful butterflies flitted among the hyacinths, multi-hued tulips and blood-red poppies that bloomed along the path. They walked in silence along the path that ran past the cluster of low white buildings and down the shoulder of the hillside on which the village was built. The tan, bricked path wound around the lake at the bottom of the ridge and out into a pleasant meadow. A bicyclist passed them, coasting down the gentle slope. Leafy young trees spread dappled shade along the path. Susan heard insects humming in the bushes and birds chirping. A complete ecology, painstakingly established and maintained. Looking at the grassy field and the clumps of taller trees standing farther along the gently curving path, she found it hard to believe that they were inside a huge man-made cylinder that was hanging in empty space a few hundred kilometers above the surface of the moon. Until she glanced up and saw that the land curved completely around overhead. "Holly." She snapped her attention back to Eberly.
"Ah, I'm sorry," she stuttered, embarrassed. I guess I wasn't listening."
He nodded, as if accepting her apology.
"Yes, I forget how beautiful this is.
You're absolutely right. None of us should take all this for granted."
"What were you saying?" she asked.
"It wasn't important." He raised his arm and swept it around dramatically. "This is the important thing, Holly, this world that you will create for yourselves."
"My name is Holly now," she reminded herself. "You can remember everything that happens to you. Remember your new name, for Jeep's sake."
Still, she asked, "Why'd you want me to change my name?"
Eberly tilted his head to one side, thinking before he answered.
I've suggested to every new recruit that they change their names. You are entering a new world, starting new lives. A new name is appropriate. Don't you agree?
Oh, right, for sure.
Yet, he sighed, very few actually follow my suggestion. They cling to the past.
It's like baptism, isn't it? Holly said.
He looked at her, and she saw something like respect in his piercing blue eyes.
Baptism, yes, born again, beginning a new life.
This'll be my third life, she told him. Eberly nodded.
I don't remember my first life, Holly said. Far as I can remember, my life started 7 years ago.
No, Eberly said firmly. Your life began 2 weeks ago, when you arrived here.
For sure. Right.
That's why you changed your name, isn't it?
Right,
she repeated, thinking, he's so buggin' serious about everything. I wish I could make him smile. Eberly stopped walking and slowly turned a full circle, taking in the world that stretched all around them and climbed over their heads to completely encircle them. I was born in deep poverty, he said, his voice low, almost a whisper. I was born prematurely, very sick. They didn't think I would live. My father ran away when I was still a baby, and my mother took up with a migrant laborer, a Mexican. He wanted me to die. If it weren't for the new morality, I would have died before I was 6 months old. They took me into their hospital. They put me through their schools. They saved me, body and soul.
I'm glad, Holly said.
The new morality saved America, Eberly explained. When the greenhouse warming flooded all the coastal areas and the food riots started, it was the new morality that brought order and decency back into our lives.
I don't remember the states at all, she said, just Cellini, nothing before that.
He chuckled. You certainly seem to have no trouble remembering anything that's happened to you since. I've never seen anyone with such a steel trap of a mind.
With a careless shrug, Holly replied, that's just the RNA treatments they gave me.
Oh, yes, of course. He started walking again, slowly. Well, Holly, here we are, both of us, and 10,000 others.
9,998, she corrected, with an impish grin.
He dipped his chin slightly in acknowledgment of her arithmetic, totally serious, oblivious to her attempt at humor. You have the opportunity to create a new world here, Eberly said, clean and whole and new. You are the most fortunate people of the ages.
You too, she said.
He made a little gesture with one hand. I'm only one man. There are 10,000 of you, minus one, I admit. You are the ones who will create this new world. It's yours to fashion as you see fit. I'm completely satisfied merely to be here, among you, and to help you in any way that I can. Holly stared at him, feeling enormous admiration welling up within her.
But Malcolm, you've got to help us build this new world. We're going to need your vision, your...
She fumbled for a word, then your dedication.
Of course,
I'll do what I can, he said. And for the first time, he smiled. Holly felt thrilled. But you must do your best, too, he added. I expect the same dedication and hard work from you that I myself am exerting. Nothing less, Holly.
She nodded silently. You must devote yourself totally to the work we are doing, Eberly said.
Totally.
I will. Holly answered. I already have, for real.
Every aspect of your life must be dedicated to our work, he insisted. There will be no time for frivolities, nor for romantic entanglements.
I don't have any romantic entanglements, Malcolm, she said in a small voice.
Silently, she added, wish I did, with you. Neither do I, he said. The task before us is too important to allow personal considerations to get in the way.
Holly said, I understand, Malcolm. I truly do.
Good. I'm glad. And Eberly thought, K carrot and stick. That's the way